Hi, this is Gabby Lewis, co-founder of Magic Spoon, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story. And every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Startup Story. Before we jump into this week's episode, I want to let you know about three incredible opportunities that have come up out of our recent launch of the Grindology Coffee and Strategy subscription. First, thanks to our partnership with Design Pickle, you have a chance to find a golden pickle worth nearly $12,000. This January, we'll ship out our first Q1 box, and within one randomly selected box will be a golden pickle that can be redeemed for a full year of unlimited graphic design services from our friends at Design Pickle. Imagine what you can do with your brand and content production by having a dedicated resource that you can tap into for anything and everything. If that sounds amazing to you, then visit grindology.com/golden pickle to learn more. Next, visit grindology.com/sample and secure your free pot of coffee. Look, 2020 was a hot mess, and just giving away a cup of coffee seemed inadequate. So we're giving away an entire pot of their Crash Pad House Blend. Again, just visit grindology.com/sample. And lastly, how would you like to advertise your business or brand for completely free on the Startup Story podcast? Yes, you can advertise your business or brand within the Startup Story podcast to reach an audience of 85,000 listeners for absolutely free. All you have to do is visit grindology.com/startup story and purchase the Grindology year-end subscription for just $176. Yes, you heard that correctly. For just $176, you can promote your brand or business to over 85,000 highly engaged listeners. And you'll still get all the normal benefits of a Grindology subscription, including the chance to find the $12,000 golden pickle. But the free ad within the Startup Story is only accessible by visiting grindology.com/startup story and purchasing the annual subscription from that landing page. We'll include all these links that I just mentioned in the show notes, so make sure you check those out. Grindology is an entrepreneurial subscription box that is created to help fuel your grind. Every shipment will include two bags of uniquely crafted coffee specifically roasted for you, the founder, hustler, entrepreneur, maker, and creator. Each shipment will also include an exclusive mug that speaks to the unique nature that is you, the entrepreneur. And lastly, every single Grindology shipment will include a copy of Grindology Magazine, the newest entrepreneurial magazine in the market. The reality is, I really need to stop calling Grindology Magazine a magazine, because it's truly more like a tactical manual just for entrepreneurs. Every single issue of Grindology will be chock full of real tactics from real business builders, not journalists. You can learn real marketing funnel strategies from those who are doing it. Learn specific user acquisition strategies from brands employing those strategies right now. Hear funding tips from startups that are just a bit farther along the capital journey than you are. Like I said, real tactics from real business builders. We ship our first box January 2021, and it will be an exclusive shipment, so make sure to secure your box today at grindology.com. And like I said, we will always include all the links that we've mentioned above within our show notes for easy access. Now let's jump into this week's episode. My guest this week is Gabby Lewis, co-founder of Magic Spoon. Magic Spoon is a company that is reimagining your favorite childhood breakfast cereals into a high-protein, low-sugar, guilt-free daily indulgence. Magic Spoon launched in April of 2019 with four amazing flavors and is sold exclusively direct-to-consumer at magicspoon.com. But this isn't Gabby's first startup venture. In fact, prior to Magic Spoon, Gabby co-founded Exo, a company that pioneered insect protein as a sustainable food source. But let me be clear, there are no insect proteins in Magic Spoon. But let me be real with you for a moment here. I love cereal, and I'm sure you do as well. In fact, I'm willing to bet you have at least two boxes of cereal in your pantry right now. I'm also willing to bet that if you're over the age of 30, that you wish you could indulge in those sugary cereals from your childhood. Well, Magic Spoon has taken all the things we love about our childhood favorites and reimagined them into a high-protein, low-carb, and zero-sugar cereal so we can enjoy them with zero health concerns. You truly have to try their cereals. They're amazing. In fact, Gabby has extended a discount code to all of you. Just visit magicspoon.com and use the code STARTUPSTORY to receive $5 off your entire order. I'm telling you, you're going to love it. How great would it be to give someone a variety pack of cereals that brings some childhood nostalgia back to them? Come on, you know you have someone in your life that is an absolute pain to buy gifts for. This is the gift-giving season, and Magic Spoon cereal would be an amazing and surprising gift to them. So again, just visit magicspoon.com and use the code STARTUPSTORY to receive $5 off your entire order. All right. Enough of the cereal talk. If I spend any more time discussing how great cereal is, I might need to rebrand the podcast, like The Breakfast Story or something like that. So with that in mind, let's start unpacking Gabby's entrepreneurial journey from the Scottish Highlands to the disruption of the largest breakfast food category.
So my dad was an entrepreneur, and my mom was and is a cognitive behavioral therapist. So my dad was always busy, hustling, working on his business, a little bit stressed, working longer hours than maybe he would have wanted to. My mom was typically a more sort of calming presence, slightly annoyingly at the time, making sure everyone was always okay, checking in a little bit too much. And, you know, I grew up in Scotland where everyone's very sarcastic, very sort of like actually anti-therapy. So there's far more of a stigma over there about going to therapy than there is here in the US. And so we'd always tease my mom a little bit for sort of trying to like therapize us when we were growing up, and she'd always just be making sure we're okay. So I think I had a little bit of both sides. And I always thought I would be an entrepreneur eventually. Unlike in the US, where I grew up in Scotland, being an entrepreneur or founder is not really looked at as a classic and admired path for someone young.
Okay.
So when you're young and you're ambitious and you're doing well in high school, it's a lot more pre-professional. You know, you're going to be a lawyer, a doctor, maybe go into finance, be a banker, but it's not really the done thing to do a startup when you're in your early 20s in Scotland. And partly that's the culture. You know, we don't sort of typically dream like in a very huge way like Americans typically do. And part of it is sort of structurally, there's not the venture capital community, you know, there's not the angel investor community. And so even if you wanted to start a business without any experience and sort of you had the vision as a 20-year-old in Scotland, it would be a harder thing to do typically. Or if you did do it, it would be a more sort of grassroots, bootstrapped business, less going and raising a seed round from a VC just based on a 5-slide pitch deck and an idea.
Yeah. So when you think, one interesting thing you said, you know, you knew you'd be an entrepreneur eventually. You're from Scotland. Did you spend all of your childhood there? How long were you in Scotland for?
I was actually born in Israel. My family moved to Scotland when I was 2. And I lived there until I was 17.
Okay.
Then I took a year off and backpacked through South America. And then I came to the US for college at Brown in Providence, Rhode Island. And then when I graduated, I moved to New York.
Got it. So that's a great timeline for us to work with. So the fact that you said, I knew I'd be an entrepreneur at some point, and here you are in Scotland as a youth at the time, that entrepreneur culture is different than maybe the American listener or even the Australian listener right now who understands what their childhood was like as an idea of like, I want to be an entrepreneur. What did that look like for you? Like when you think of that idea in your teens, what did that look like for you?
Yeah, and I actually think I should sort of slightly change what I said. You know, I'm comparing Scotland to the US, but really what I'm actually doing is comparing Scotland to New York or San Francisco.
Oh, so there you go.
Okay. I think probably what's actually true is Scotland is maybe similar to a lot of the US, just not similar to where I live now, which is New York or some of the startups seen in San Francisco. So being an entrepreneur, I think for me growing up, it was, you know, building a business and working hard and bootstrapping it. Like I never heard of the idea of outside investors. And so it was a sort of different, slower process. And it was probably built on a more sort of fundamental insight as opposed to a sort of like big, crazy idea that maybe has a 80% chance of failure. But if it pays off, it pays off huge. You know, like that.
Yeah.
I didn't know anyone who like tried to do that sort of thing. Yeah. Like, you know, everyone in my family or family friends that had businesses, they were real solid businesses that employed people, but they sort of did normal day-to-day things. You know, they weren't tech startups.
Yeah. Awesome. So you ended up going to Brown in the US. At this point in the game, having spent a year off in South America, I mean, again, I've heard from so many different founders how pivotal travel was to their entrepreneurial journey, just having a different perspective than the area they grew up in. Having had that year of travel, ending up in Brown and Rhode Island as well, what did you think, what was starting to percolate from an idea perspective of what your entrepreneurial vision might have been at the time? Not maybe necessarily what you knew was going to come when we talk about EXO and now Magic Spoon, but what did you think was going to be this initiative and venture you were going to grow?
When I arrived at Brown after backpacking for a year in South America, I still thought I was probably going to go into finance for a while or do something other than start a business for a while.
Okay.
I arrived at Brown thinking I was going to major in economics and mathematics, that I was going to work very hard, that I was probably going to join a big bank or a hedge fund or something. And a couple of things happened. One, I hated economics and I hated mathematics even more. And I really enjoyed philosophy. So I started majoring in philosophy. You know, my parents, they let me go to the US for college, which costs more than going to Scotland for college.
Yeah.
And so they didn't let me just major in philosophy. So I ended up doing philosophy and just enough economics and mathematics classes to do the double major. So it was still a little bit employable if it came to that. Towards the end of my time at Brown, you know, I had the sort of major in economics and mathematics. I'd spent a summer at a hedge fund, but I sort of realized, why wait? You know, I think a lot of people have this idea hammered into them that they will do like 2 years in banking or consulting, at least if they're coming from a certain kind of educational background. Yeah. They'll do that first, they'll like pay their dues, and then they'll start a business. And when people pressed me, and if I press other people who tell me that's what they're doing, typically there's not a good reason for doing that, other than that's just a done thing for a certain kind of person who's gone through a certain kind of educational system. Then I also think, and this goes back to when I was traveling, I realized that like, the happiest people I came across like weren't the wealthiest people. I'm clearly not going to be the happiest version of me if I spend like 2 years working 12-hour days in finance. And so like, what's the point? Yeah. Why not just go straight to what I think I want to do, which is like work for myself, do something interesting that I'm passionate about, and like build a business. And the idea for EXO had been sort of percolating, which we can talk about. And so I did that.
How? Okay. Before I ask this question, because if I ask this question before people understand what EXO is, they won't understand the basis for my question. So can you share with my audience what EXO was?
Yes. EXO is a company that is developing insect protein as an alternative food source. So insects in general and crickets specifically are packed full of protein and they're extremely sustainable as a food source. So to raise them per gram of protein requires less water, less feed, less space than traditional protein sources, whether animal-based or plant-based. So rationally, there's good arguments for people to eat crickets and insects as a food source. EXO, we started to try and cross over or break down that psychological barrier, which many of us, at least in the Western part of the world, have, and we have this aversion to eating insects, which is not grounded in logic or reality, it's purely grounded in culture. And so we thought if we could come up with a way to convince people to eat these foods they think are weird, and if we could make these things aspirational and cool and create some kind of product that makes it easy to consume insect protein, that could transform the food system, have massive environmental benefits, and also just be fun.
Okay, so here you are, ending your time at Brown, realizing I don't want to work in finance. I don't want to take these 2 years off. I just want to, you know, the happiest people you met were not the wealthiest. Like you have this idea that, you know what, I'm just going to start my own thing now. That said, I don't think most people, their launching point is, I wonder how I can popularize insect proteins in some edible form whatsoever. So first, let's put a date stamp on this. When did this idea come to be? And second, why did you want that to be the first? Now, I understand what you wanted to do with it, but why did you say this was my launching point?
Timeline-wise, we are now in early 2013.
Okay.
So this is a few months before we graduated. And it was a slower process than simply saying, I'm going to start an insect protein company. It started off as I was very into CrossFit and I was doing the paleo diet, which at the time were two huge trends that still exist to some degree. And the protein bar market then, 7 years ago, was not what it is today. So there was no protein bar that satisfied the requirements of the paleo diet at the time. And that was like the biggest nutrition trend. And so I had an idea to start the first paleo protein bar company. As I was working on it, some other company came out, this company actually doesn't exist anymore, but they came out with the exact same thing.
Okay.
The same ingredients, the same flavors, like everything. And so I thought, okay, I've got to pivot this idea somehow. And my college roommate at the time, Greg, who was the co-founder at EXO and my co-founder of my current company, he said to me, what if you put crickets in your protein bar? And I said, that's a ridiculous idea. Why would we ever do that? And he sent me some articles. Turns out that at the time, there had been a United Nations report, which was their most downloaded report in the United Nations history, about how if we want to save the world, improve the food system, deal with overpopulation, we need more sustainable food sources. And one of the ideas put forward was insects, given how sustainable they are. There was also a BBC article around that time. And so people were talking about this idea of eating insects for nutrition and environmental reasons, but nobody was talking about how you actually get people to do it. And so we thought, what if we combine these ideas? What if we create a protein bar that is geared towards CrossFit, paleo, all these people who actually care more about nutrition than anything else, and actually pride themselves on being a little bit countercultural and doing things that other people think are a little bit weird? What if we created a cricket-based protein bar, sold it to these niche audiences, and that was how we sort of introduced this new sustainable protein to the world? And that was the genesis of the idea.
It is a very big goal to try and popularize an insect-based nutritional food product, okay? In the U.S. especially, we're vanity-driven. I'm just going to call it what it is. I mean, the U.S. Americans are vanity-driven. And the idea of selling a product that you have to popularize first in order to really even get them to try it seems just like a monumental feat. So when you think back to the early days of EXO, the launching point of EXO, where you have a product you're ready to bring to market, what were some of the thought processes across the founding team, those who are helping you with marketing, in order to get people to be open to the idea of a insect-based protein?
Firstly, we were young and we were naive and we were overly confident and ambitious. So I don't think I would have started that business now. And I don't think it was necessarily the most rational decision to do it. But with that being said, there was some logic to the marketing, and it was a marketing challenge, that business, over anything else.
Yeah.
The question was, how do you take this thing that people think is gross and how do you make it cool? And there were a couple of tactics we took. One was we partnered with a 3 Michelin starred chef, and he developed all of our recipes. He helped us sort of seed it with some of the top chefs in the world. And so we were sort of playing into this idea of celebrity chefs being the sort of next frontier of rock star and celebrities. And actually, at the same time that we were working on this, a lot of the best restaurants in the world were featuring insects on their menu for sort of culinary reasons. There was also a lot of case studies we had of other products or other food ingredients that had been weird at some point and now we think of as very mainstream. Things like sushi, lobster, bone broth. There's lots of foods that a certain amount of time ago people thought was weird or gross and now we think is totally normal. And the way you usually get it across the chasm is you create an introductory vehicle. And so for sushi, it was the California roll, where they basically wrap the raw fish in rice and seaweed and avocado, and they like made it sort of more palatable for Westerners. And so we knew we had to create a similar thing to the California roll, and that was where the protein bar came in. So we made a protein powder from the crickets, no taste, no smell, you'd never know, and we sort of eased people into it that way.
Interesting. And the reason I asked that question, because I do believe that there's probably a lot of learnings in that go-to-market strategy that you brought into Magic Spoon, right? I mean, obviously, it's not nearly as different than what might be out there, other than some of the nuances of the health side of it. But from a cultural perspective, we love cereal. Everyone loves cereal. So it's a little bit easier of an adoption. So when I look back at the challenges you might have had with EXO, I think those must have been tremendous learnings for you coming into Magic Spoon.
Oh, yeah. I mean, once you've tried to sell crickets, selling cereal is a breeze.
I love that. Absolutely love it. Now, I had made an error in a statement where I had said what XO was, and you had said XO is still around. The reason I made that assumption is that because you're now with Magic Spoon. So what was the life cycle of your involvement? What was the life cycle of XO where it is now? And what was your involvement and what was your exit out?
Yeah, so we started XO in 2013. We sold the business to one of our suppliers about 2 years ago. Okay. And so from that moment, neither myself nor my co-founder have had any involvement in the business, but it does still exist. And actually, I'm in Texas right now, and I was at a gas station yesterday, and I saw an XO bar at the checkout, which was the first time I've seen one in real life in a couple of years. That was quite cool to see.
That's awesome. As you're no longer with XO, and you sell this company, again, your first startup, you have a successful exit, which is incredible, especially given what you accomplished with making insect proteins, something that consumers were buying. Again, absolutely amazing to me. The ideas that entrepreneurs come up with continues to just blow my mind with the diversity of problems people try to solve. I absolutely love, one of my greatest, the greatest parts about doing the startup story is hearing just the diversity of ideas and problems that people see out there and try to solve. So now as you're exiting XO, what was your thoughts? Like, take some time off. I've got some money in the bank. Let's travel again. Like, what was your immediate process as you were ending your time with XO?
I knew I wanted to stay in the food and beverage world. I knew I wanted to start something else pretty quickly. We had an exit, but it wasn't a retire on a private island kind of exit. Okay. I think it left us really hungry. You know, we had such huge ambitions for that business. We wanted to replace soy protein as the go-to protein source for like every product in the grocery store. And we obviously, you know, we sold the business, but we didn't go that far.
Yeah.
So it left us very hungry for more. And it left us with learnings around how we can start a food business and grow it much bigger, much faster. It left us with an appreciation for product market fit that I didn't have before. Maybe this is more of a sort of Silicon Valley mindset. A lot of entrepreneurs think, doesn't really matter what the product is. If you're a good entrepreneur with hustle and grind, you can just like make it work. And I think a lot of venture capitalists reinforce that slightly mistaken idea that the business idea is less important than the founder. You know, there's a mantra, it's like bet on the jockey, which I think a lot of founders internalize, which is obviously partly true. But I didn't until now have a deep appreciation for just how much product market fit changes the game.
Yes.
And so we spent a lot more time making sure we picked the right idea. And we had certain criteria based on our experience last time. You know, we needed an idea that we could lean very heavily into influencer marketing with, because we believed that was going to be part of the future of how you market products online. We wanted a product that was light and easy to ship, so it made for an efficient and profitable direct-to-consumer business, and a few other criteria as well. And we ended up with cereal. That's what we wanted to get into next.
That's incredible. So XO was a two-year endeavor for you.
Longer, sorry. So XO was started in 2013. We sold it probably 2018. So it was about 5.5, 6 years.
Got it. Yeah. So 2018. So when would you consider the launch of Magic Spoon?
We publicly launched April of 2019.
April of 2019. So you really got into the research side of it very quickly in order to bring something to market. Really just, we'll call it 16 months after the fact of leaving XO. So for those who may not know, and if they're living in a vacuum, you know, they don't know, but I think anyone on Instagram should know who Magic Spoon is at this point. Again, whether it be because of marketing, paid ads, influencer marketing, whatever the case may be, I feel like I see Magic Spoon all the time. And maybe it's because of just, I knew we were going to be recording. And so I'm, you know, the algorithm just feeds me Magic Spoon things all the time, whether it gets me, but Magic Spoon's everywhere. So, but for those who might be living in a vacuum, can you explain what Magic Spoon is to my audience?
Magic Spoon is a breakfast cereal company. We reimagine all of your favorite childhood breakfast cereals into a product that is high protein, low carb, and has zero sugar. So we have a handful of flavors: chocolate, frosted, fruity, more recently peanut butter, salted caramel, and they're all gluten-free, grain-free, keto-friendly, no sugar. Like I said, high protein, low carb. Tick every nutritional box you might want to tick. except they look and taste like they are junk sugary cereals.
And that is for real. Like that last sentence right there, they look and taste like they are junk sugary cereals, is 100% true. They are so unbelievably good. It is amazing. Now, I have to ask, because I've consumed who knows how many boxes of Magic Spoon in my up to this point, not knowing EXO as part of your journey prior to a couple days ago.
I see where this is going.
Are there insect proteins in Magic Spoon?
No, we wouldn't have been able to slip that one in without people noticing. There are zero insects in Magic Spoon.
I just wanted to get that out there so people weren't trying to falsely make connections. So one, that's excellent. So when you think of your going to market strategy for Magic Spoon, having come off the learnings of EXO, what were some things that you immediately did differently because of what you learned in your first journey? Because I believe every single, whether the startup was a success or a failure, there are tremendous learnings that come from that season that make our next one even better. So what for you was critical during your time of building EXO did you bring into your development and launch of Magic Spoon?
So we launched Magic Spoon primarily with influencer marketing. We saw at EXO, even having a product with very little product market fit, the power of a health and wellness influencer in moving units online. And so with Magic Spoon, we leaned very hard into that. The first round of financing we raised, half of it was from health and wellness influencers. These are not huge people with 20 million followings. These are people with very passionate 100 to 500,000 followings. And so we have a few dozen of those types of health and wellness influencers who invested in our business. And so at launch, they were able to push it out to their audiences. That allowed us to hit scale very early on without spending an insane amount of money on Instagram ads that a comparable brand might have to spend in order to get that early scale. So that was one big thing. You know, another, we built a lot of relationships with EXO that we were able to use for Magic Spoon. So, you know, our branding agency for Magic Spoon was a branding agency we'd met during our time at EXO. Various other sort of service providers we'd met over the years are people that we still work with. Lots of our investors backed us again. So sort of every part of the business was made faster and easier just because we've done it once before.
Yeah. When you think back to EXO, and one of the things we didn't talk was about funding. And in fact, you just brought it up right here when it came to Magic Spoon. EXO, all bootstrap self-funded, or was there outside capital?
No, there was outside capital. We probably raised about $7 million for that business.
Okay. And then for Magic Spoon, obviously there was investment capital that was brought in. Having come off the success of EXO, there's a chance you probably could have done it bootstrapped. Was the venture capital intentional, or was there maybe some doubt that you could have done it bootstrapped?
A bit of both. The cereal market is enormous, and we couldn't understand why nobody had done before what we're now doing. And in the past year since we started doing it, there are more others doing it than I can count on one hand, maybe even than I can count on two hands. And we knew that was going to happen if we had any success. You know, we also know that things like branding, a lot of these things are to some extent a commodity. And at a certain point, if there's enough competition, money becomes, frankly, really, really important. Mm. And so we wanted to make sure that we were well capitalized from the start. And that if we had some early success and a bunch of copycats came along, we could, you know, afford to stay ahead. That would have been quite tricky if we were bootstrapping it. And we also wanted to move very quickly. And to move quickly and to sort of, you know, lock in zero-sum marketing channels, certain podcasts, certain influencers, requires a lot of upfront cash. And so we knew we sort of had to raise money early.
Now, was your launch strategy solely direct-to-consumer, or were you in retail from day one?
We're actually still not in retail. So we're 100% direct-to-consumer today, and we have been since we launched.
You're only direct-to-consumer?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't know where I got that idea. You were retail. I wonder if maybe there was just some influencer who was carrying around a box of Magic Spoon through a store. I somehow assumed.
There's a handful of stores that just buy full-price product from our website and put it on their shelves. You know, nationwide Walmart isn't doing that. But there's some small stores that do that. So it's possible you saw it somewhere. But no, our business is exclusively direct-to-consumer.
Now, do you plan on staying that way?
Not forever. I don't think you can scale any business to the point at which we want to scale Magic Spoon purely D2C. Mm-hmm. And that's true whether you're selling glasses or mattresses or cereal. That being said, I don't know where that ceiling of a D2C business is for Serial. Could be 50 million, could be 200 million. I don't know, but I do know it exists.
Yeah.
And so we will go to retail at some point to keep growing, but it's not in the immediate future.
Just because of how nuanced your brand is, and your brand is just so well positioned online, does the retailer who carries you, is that of consideration to you? Are there certain retailers you're like, you know, we're not going to put Magic Spoon in that because it's just not on brand with who it is we are?
We're considering very carefully who we eventually partner with, but it's not about what retailer is on brand or not on brand, because by definition, the only people that care about that are the people that are in the store. And so even if we picked the most off-brand retailer, if we put it on their shelves, it's customers that love that retailer who are going to see us there. And so the same customer that sees us through an Instagram ad probably won't even know we're there. So I'm not too concerned about retailers that might be viewed as on or off brand.
Okay.
You know, I'm more concerned about the fact that we're a relatively new type of product. So of course cereal exists, but there's not a lot of high protein, low carb cereal on shelves. And there's also not a lot of cereal on shelves at our price point. And so those are the types of things we consider. What does the competitive set look like?
Yeah.
Where in the store would the retailer put us? What does their customer typically look like? What does their customer care about? It's things like that more than the sort of brand of the retailer matching with our brand.
Okay. And the reason I was asking that question, because obviously there's certain brands that immediately come to mind when I think of a Magic Spoon. I think, oh my gosh, a Trader Joe's would be, you know, a great fit for this. A mm-hmm. Whole Foods would be a great fit for this. A Kroger doesn't seem like a great fit, but to your point, if you're at a Kroger, it's not because of a brand of Kroger. You're there for convenience and whatever the case may be. So,
yeah, I mean, all these things trade off with each other. And you have a similar trade off when you look at influencers, for example. If we only worked with influencers that were most on brand for us, right? So influencers who have Instagram pages that are colorful and all about food and nutrition and joyful recipes, that would limit the scale we got to. And so we don't do that. You know, we work with those influencers. Yeah. We also work with people who are 50 years older than our like target demographic, because they also love cereal and like want high protein foods, even if you might not look at their Instagram pages and think they are on brand for Magic Spoon. So it's going to be a similar approach for retail. We want to create a product that has mass mainstream appeal here. And part of that means not being too precious about what we think our brand is and what we might think is off brand.
That's a great point. I think a lot of times from a early days in the startup, we can hold that brand itself so tightly and even lose perspective of what it is that we're about. And that's the product and the service versus the brand itself. So that's great insight. So when we think back to the fact that you launched April of 2019, I mean, we're talking 18 months ago and just massive, massive success. With that success comes tremendous logistics challenges. So when you think of your 18 months, what have been some of the greatest challenges for you?
A lot of challenges. You know, the first month was hard. We had an amazing launch. We had an amazing launch day. Honestly, at launch day, we realized this was going to be bigger than we thought it was going to be. And we knew we had to sort of reevaluate everything. So those first few weeks, we had to rethink where we're making it. We had to rethink how we're making it. We had to rethink the logistics partners, where we're shipping from, all of that stuff, even down to how we're structuring our payment with our digital marketing agency. You know, like every single decision we'd made was based on assumptions that this thing was going to be much smaller than in fact it turned out to be. Even on day one, we could tell.
Can we share a day one number? Like, what was your expectation for day one? And what happened that had you questioning everything?
We were expecting our first day of sales to be in the hundreds of boxes of cereal at most, and it ended up being in the many thousands of boxes of cereal on the first day.
That's incredible. I mean, what an amazing multiple. And I could see how the challenges that would come from that, especially again, all the way down supply chain, right? And in fact, just last week, we released an episode with Dylan Jacob, the founder of Brewmate. And one of his early day challenges were very much logistics. You know, he talks about his year two growth. It could have been so much greater had he had a solution for logistics until he partnered with a brand like Shipmunk that was able to solve a lot of things for him. So when you think about your 18 months, what is something you wish you would have had in place knowing what you know now?
More people, probably. Hiring takes time in normal periods. It takes even more time during the weird period that we're in right now, where you can't meet people face to face. So I think we've constantly been playing catch up in terms of building our team. Part of that is we're probably a little bit too selective, honestly. We have too many rounds of interviews, probably. We're probably a little bit too perfectionist in terms of our hiring. And we could hire faster, probably, if I'm being self-critical. But we've been chronically understaffed since we launched. I've had people tell me that you should hire for 6 months ahead, you know, hire for the business you think you're going to be in 6 months. But that always feels a little bit silly, because for a startup, who knows what you're going to be in 6 months. Yeah. And so to say, oh, maybe we'll need a chief of staff in 6 months, let's hire that person now, even though I don't even know what they do right now, just always feels a little bit silly. But looking back on the last 18 months, I do wish we'd hired a little bit faster, even just simple hires like maybe an extra person on the customer service team, for example, just knowing that kind of the volume of inbound tickets that we get can grow very quickly in an unexpected way and makes everyone's job harder if we fall behind on that. So I'd say hiring further ahead of time would be one of the learnings.
I want to ask a couple of questions about the hiring challenges, because I think a lot of people don't think about those things, or you know, they read it so many books that talk about how critical a great hire is, how toxic a bad hire is, and they create these multiple layers and they're unnecessary in the hiring process. So I want to talk about that. But I do want to ask, from a startup perspective, when customer service, right, there are ways to outsource certain things. Why bring certain things internal so early on?
So we're probably a case study on how not to bring things internally. As a general rule, we have more agencies than I can count. We have several agencies that just focus on influencer marketing. We have multiple freelance designers. You know, we have a lot of agencies you work with. So I'm not anti-agency at all. That being said, it gets hard to manage at a certain point. And I think the goal of most companies is to bring most things in-house. So we're trying to do that for various departments. And then there's certain things, I mean, customer service is a good example, that lots of people do outsource, but for us, customer service is really the front lines of the business. And if something goes wrong, customer service knows before anyone else. Even if it's something on the operations side, or even if it's something on the growth marketing or digital advertising side, customer service knows before the person who's supposed to know knows, because a customer catches it and they write in.
Yeah.
So it's very important for us to have those people sitting beside us now, like a Zoom call away from us, to be able to let us know, like, oh, this ad is getting some comments. People don't like the model that we chose to use. Or, oh, this random page on the website that you didn't think anybody goes to, actually the button's broken on it and we got 4 complaints about it in the past hour. Things like that if we use an outsourced customer service agency that was just clocking in, clocking out, using templated responses, those problems wouldn't bubble up as quickly as they do. That's sort of the value we see there.
Okay. Now onto the hiring question. How did hiring become, to use your words, as long or as complicated as it has become in Magic Spoon? Again, you're a startup. I suspect it all started with you and a co-founder first, and maybe hire number 3 and 4. And how did it get to the point that it is, and how could you streamline it?
Yeah. And just to be, you know, to be clear, it's deliberately long. I can't quite decide if it's too long or not, but part of it is, when you're at the stage we're at, you're hiring single people for each department. And so if you're only hiring one digital marketer, you're only hiring one operations person, ideally they're going to be the person and they're going to build out a team and they're going to be leading that department for several years. And so they need to be really, really good. And so our standard for hiring our first or even our second digital marketer is much, much higher than our standard for hiring our 10th digital marketer, just because of the team they need to build and like the responsibility they're going to have. So part of it is just by nature of the stage we're at, we want to take longer and we need to have higher standards than if we were a year from now hiring our 30th or 40th employee. Right now we're 10 people. So that's part of it.
Got it.
We have become a lot more streamlined. So there's a few sort of tricks we've discovered. One thing we do now is I never do a first round interview for more than 15 minutes. And usually the first round interviews last 10 minutes and it's always over video. So that's like the first stage for any role we interview with is a 10 to 15 minute video. We call them meet and greets, because you can usually tell when you get an interview within a few minutes if it's worth really digging in or not. And we spent too much time knowing that in minute 5 and then feeling bad ending an interview that it's been scheduled for an hour after like the 30 minute mark. So now we just don't let anybody do first round interviews for longer than 15 minutes. We always cut them off there. So that's helped streamline it a lot. And then there's also been some benefits of the pandemic in terms of forcing us to become better at hiring, actually. So it's very easy to get distracted by liking someone's company in an interview. You know, if you're meeting someone for a coffee or an in-person interview, some of your sort of internal biases can take over. You're not aware of it. People can maybe sound smarter than they are with their body language or how they project themselves. I'm frequently told my Scottish accent makes me sound smarter than I am. So yeah, that goes both ways. But with not being able to meet people in person, we rely a lot more on projects and case studies and written answers. And that removes a lot of the bias from the hiring process and allows us to more accurately replicate them sort of doing the day-to-day function of the job. So we've been doing a lot more of those sorts of things in the hiring process, which has also streamlined everything.
Excellent. Now, for a startup, one of the most compelling hires and yet the most challenging hires is the CFO position. It's the one that is overseeing the financials and investing. Have you gotten to a point where you have a CFO yet?
We do not. We have like a part-time CFO,
okay,
but not a full-time in-house CFO.
The reason I say it's some of the most compelling is there are things, and correct me if you don't agree, but there are things inside the business financials that we, as the founders and entrepreneurs, we may not see because we're only seeing certain metrics that are key to us. And it's the CFO that can come in and chime in and say, you know what? We need to rethink our pricing strategy. We need to rethink our payment cycles, whatever the case may be. Your part-time CFO, your fractional CFO, how important has that position been for you as you grow Magic Spoon?
He's probably going to listen, so I'm going to be very careful what I say now. No, he's great. And to your point, yes. I mean, he points out things that we're not thinking about and we're not looking for. It's impossible as a founder to focus on more than a few KPIs, basically.
Yeah.
He questions the KPIs, which is important. And he also draws attention to other things we might miss. You know, there's, I think if you ask most founders what they spend most money on, maybe of the five things they guessed, like they'd be missing one or two probably. There's things that you don't realize you're spending a lot of money on until somebody points it out. And so having someone who's laser focused on every line item only helps.
Yeah. I've heard many, many different success stories where they thought the business was here, they were ready to scale, they finally leaned in on a CFO, and then they just realized, wait a second, there's a few more things we need to put in place before we just like pull that lever and just go crazy with that growth. I know for myself, as a salesperson, as a founder, like I can so easily fall into the hype. Like even with the KPIs, I can fall into my own personal hype. And so to have an outside party come in and like, James, like, you need to like check yourself. Let's have a reality check real quick. Like you can see all these metrics. That's great. But let's talk about cash flow for a second here. You know, when you look at the forward, you know, man, Magic Spoon is so young. It blows my mind that it's so young because it seems like a brand that I've been acquainted with for quite some time. And the success that you're seeing is tremendous. But when you think forward, is it always just cereal? What does Magic Spoon look like to you? Let's say if we were having a Where Are They Now episode in 5 years.
I think it'll be mostly still cereal. Cereal is an enormous market that everybody, product everybody eats. So most startups, most food companies, they need to eventually build a platform. They need to have other products that they introduce. But that's because most markets, most aisles of the grocery store are not as extensive as cereal is. And cereal is one of a handful of products where if you walk down the street and saw 10 people, 10 out of 10 of them would have a box of cereal in their cabinet, probably 5 or 10 boxes of cereal in their cabinet.
Yeah.
So there's really no need for us to go much beyond cereal. And I think companies typically go beyond their core product when they need to, right? When they tap out that market, when maybe their cost of acquisition is rising and they need to extend their lifetime value, or they just need to take up more areas in the grocery store. But I don't think you need to if you're playing in a market as big as cereal. Mm. That being said, if we continue to run this business for 20 years, I'd be surprised at that point if we were only doing cereal. But if we're talking about a sort of reasonable 4 to 7 year timeline, I think we're going to be focused on cereal throughout that time.
With the success that you've had with Magic Spoon and XO before, you know, you've been in this space for 18 months with Magic Spoon. You had XO for 5-6 years roughly for that. So you've been in the food space for some time. One of the things that I love about the Startup Story is giving people access to founders like yourself to get that guidance and mentorship that really a lot of times they wouldn't have access to, right? So if you were having a coffee with one of my listeners that had an idea for a food product and all they had was a napkin with some thought, I guess a napkin would be weird for a food product, but they had a notepad with some ideas on what they wanted to do. What guidance would you give them on how to go from that notepad to concept to product launch?
The first thing is to make sure it's the right idea. And I think the key there is pick an idea that's not too sexy. It's very easy to want to make the next kombucha or cannabis-infused beverage or non-alcoholic seltzer. But those ideas that seem so of the moment and seems like there's a massive opportunity for, there's probably 10 other founders with the same idea working on their brand, getting ready to launch right now. And it's going to be really hard to break through. I think at the idea stage, you want to try and find something that's ideally a huge market that others have overlooked. So cereal worked for us a couple of years ago. Nobody was really thinking the cereal market needed to be disrupted or innovated. People had sort of written the cereal market off as this big sluggish category that had year over year decline. And so finding big markets like that, that others are overlooking, I think is one of the keys to sourcing the idea in the first place.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Now, once you have that idea and that framework, how does someone start moving into some type of productions for a real concept? How does one start then testing? Like, how can this person you're mentoring get to a point where they are actually selling their product online? What is that? What is that next step? Is it to actually get a product? Is there testing to be done without a product? And food, as an outsider, I think you've got to have a product. People have got to be eating it in order to test it.
Yeah, and it depends on the product. Some products you can make yourself in your kitchen. And so that's relatively easy to make a prototype and just give people to try. And it doesn't need to be a formal focus group of 20 strangers who fill out forms. For both of our businesses, it was making a small batch and giving it to friends. Our first batch of EXO protein bars, we gave it out to people at our house on campus at a party one night, and people, I think, didn't realize they were eating crickets, but they gave us feedback on the taste of the protein bar. And so taste is obviously paramount when it comes to food. All these other benefits, whether it's price point, health attributes, for food, that's secondary. And if people don't think it tastes delicious, then none of that other stuff matters. That doesn't need to mean it tastes the best product in its category, right? Every food product has trade-offs. And so you need to figure out where on the taste, nutrition, price point spectrum you want to be. And every product you could pick up in the grocery store has made trade-offs, right? You cannot be the most delicious, the cheapest, and the healthiest. Yeah. You're going to be like two of the three, and you're going to be somewhere in the middle there. And so for Magic Spoon, we decided to make it really, really healthy and 90% as tasty as the unhealthy cereals. You can't be 100% and 100%. So there's like a little bit of sacrifice in taste. It tastes almost as good as the junk cereals, but it's 100 times healthier.
I love it. Absolutely love it. When we think about your current day, right? I mean, I suspect the pandemic probably boded well for the sale of Magic Spoon, right? I mean, e-commerce went on an increase and a rise. New foods, unique foods was probably very compelling because a lot of people put on the quarantine 15 or whatever that number is for certain people. So I suspect that probably did well for you. When you think of the challenges that you faced going into 2021, coming off of what was probably a fairly successful year for Magic Spoon, what are those challenges that you look to solve for 2021?
Couple of things. I'd say the first is figuring out how we continue to innovate, knowing that we want to stay very focused at the same time. In order to get customers to keep coming back on a D2C business, you need something fresh and something new. And I think that's why a lot of companies are tempted to release all these new product lines and expand to a platform. But you also want to stay focused and you want to do one thing very well. So for us, trying to figure out how do we have the best of both worlds? How do we stay focused and be the best in the business at creating healthy, delicious cereal and doing nothing but that.
Yeah.
But also make sure that our brand is growing and innovating and that we're not becoming stale and we're not just like stagnant. And so one of the solutions is new flavors. So that's a lot of what we're working on the product development side. We have new flavors that launch basically every 8 weeks. And so formulating them, design, packaging, launch plan. That takes a lot of work, and that cycle is very tight. And there's a sort of consumer feedback piece that comes in at both ends, where the consumer helps us figure out what the flavor is that we're going to launch. And then also the consumer helps us figure out whether we keep it or whether it was just a limited edition flavor as well. So that's a big focus. And then the part of the business where I'm spending most of my time, which we discussed, is really just hiring. So our team has doubled since March, and it's probably going to double again in the next 6 months.
Wow.
So still a very small team, but we've gone from 5 to now 10 or 11, and we'll probably be 15 or 20 in a few months' time.
That's remarkable. As our time comes to an end, I want to honor your time. I want to honor the time of our listeners. And at the end of every episode, I always bring these three questions to our founder, because I think the perspective that our founders have is critical for my listeners for multiple reasons. That first question has to do with the idea of entrepreneurship. There's a lot of personas that are painted by mainstream media of what entrepreneurship is. But do you think anybody can be an entrepreneur? Now, I want to clarify, not everyone wants to be an entrepreneur. But do you think anybody can be an entrepreneur, or is it a certain genetic makeup?
I don't think it's a genetic makeup. I think if anyone wants to be an entrepreneur, they probably can be. Obviously, if you start defining entrepreneur to be a narrow definition of somebody who can raise $100 million in capital and build the next rocket company or Tesla, that, you know, I don't think anybody can do that. I think I probably can't do that. But entrepreneur, broadly defined, is having a new idea, bringing it into the world and growing it. Yeah, I think anybody can do that.
Do you think, because you started off with the scaling, so I want to peel at this a little bit. I want to unpack this a bit. Mm. You started off with the idea of the rockets and the Tesla, right? Obviously, there's one Elon Musk in the world. Like, I don't think there's anybody that's ever going to be able to disrupt fintech with PayPal, then move on to electric vehicles and then rockets like Elon. Elon is an anomaly. In fact, we had Steve Jurvetson on, who was one of the early investors in SpaceX and Tesla, and a good friend of Elon. And even he says, between him, Elon, and Steve Jobs, like they're both anomalies, but there's only one Elon. He is the quintessential persona of the American dream. You know, the immigrant coming over and doing what he has done. You started off with that idea of entrepreneurship. And I think there probably is a level of thought out there that that is what entrepreneurship is. How do you look at entrepreneurship?
I think I define it in the broadest possible sense, which, you know, I think an entrepreneur is anybody who has an idea for something that doesn't exist and brings it into the world and makes it exist. And that could be someone who has an idea for a better nail salon who creates it for him or herself, or it could be someone who has an idea for an entirely new food group or an entirely new vehicle. And there are very different skills and personality traits that are required for different kinds of businesses and different kinds of scale. And so in the same way that I might be the perfect person to take Magic Spoon from zero to 75, 100 million in sales, let's say, I might not be the perfect CEO to take it from 100 million to 500 million. You can make similar points for different businesses. You know, I think the same is true for different types of entrepreneurship and starting different kinds of businesses. But that's not to say that not everybody can be an entrepreneur for a business broadly defined.
Oh, I love that. Absolutely love that. Thank you for answering that secondary question where we peel that back a bit. I love getting the insight from those who are executing and doing, because for those listeners that I call them the wantrepreneurs, right? They have a 9-to-5, they have a book full of dreams and ideas, but there's some narrative as to why they don't move on it. And for them to have the perspective of someone like yourself who's sitting in a place that they probably desire to be one day, to hear that there's a potential for it, as long as you want it bad enough, anyone can do it. It's not a genetic makeup.
Yeah. And I also just want to be clear. I mean, there. I don't mean to make it sound easier than it is for certain people, right? Like, I had a lot of advantages going into this, you know, going to a certain university, having a certain network when I graduated that made doing certain things like raising investor money easier than someone that doesn't have that, background. So, you know, there are parts that are easier or harder depending on where you're coming from, but I don't believe it's like about who you are fundamentally.
Absolutely. Oh, love that. Absolutely love it. The other thing that I don't believe is that I don't believe it's a solo journey. I don't believe this idea that, you know, it's just you and your laptop in order to build this next disruptive thing and just nose to the grindstone all the time. You're isolating yourself. You're in a sensory deprivation chamber the whole time. Like, again, it has worked. It is an anomaly. It is not the norm, but people are starting to believe it's the norm. And so this next question is about disrupting that idea. And I believe the way we disrupt that idea is when we hear from successful people, all the people that they look to with gratitude for those who have contributed to their journey. So when you look back on your life entrepreneurial journey, who are the people you point to with such immense gratitude for where you are today?
Oh, wow. Great question. I mean, I think maybe a cheesy answer, but I think my parents, probably first and foremost, not only for everything that went into my childhood and raising me, but also for being okay with me making the decision that must have seemed ridiculous at the time to not take a high-paying job in finance and instead start a cricket protein company. I mean, that was objectively a ridiculous decision that everybody told me was wrong. And my mom said, do what'll make you happy. Follow your dreams.
I love it.
So, you know, if they hadn't done that, then I probably wouldn't be sitting here.
I love it. Yeah. I always say that if I had to trim the startup story to 20 minutes, I would find some way to accelerate the story part and get to that question, because it's so powerful for people to hear the fact that successful people didn't get there on their own. I love that question so much.
Part of it is not getting there on your own. And part of it is none of this stuff happens as quickly as people think,
yes,
right?
So
there's,
yes,
at least in the food industry, every time a new company gets sold, people joke that it's like an 11-year overnight success, yes, right? There are all these brands that oftentimes brands actually say they launched a few years later than they did. Maybe they rebranded or something, which sort of gives them permission to say they're only a 4-year-old brand.
Yeah.
But actually, the founder was working on it with other people for like 5 years prior to those 4 years he or she talks about.
Yeah.
So stuff takes time and it takes a lot of people.
Yes, it does. Absolutely. So as our episode comes to a close, we've been talking to tens of thousands of entrepreneurs and wantrepreneurs at a high level of just your journey. We've covered a few tactical moments. But this last bit, I'd like to afford an opportunity for you to speak to just one of my listeners. And maybe that is the entrepreneur who is on the brink of losing everything because of COVID. I have no idea. Maybe it's the entrepreneur who is not going to lose their business, but they've continually having challenges trying to get traction and any type of scale, or maybe even having a problem finding real product market fit. Or maybe it's the entrepreneur who has that 9-to-5 and a book full of dreams and ideas, but some hesitation to move forward. Whatever that persona is, who would you like to speak to as we wrap your startup story episode?
Seeing as this will be heard by a lot more people, I'm going to try and make it broadly applicable, but be a specific problem or challenge. And I think if you are someone who thinks entrepreneurship is a big black box and doesn't know where to start, and there's so many decisions to make, and it seems like there's so much just to go into launching a company, I think it's very important to recognize that you only really need to be good at a couple of things to have a successful company. And so if you're trying to launch an online business, for example, selling a product, it's very easy to trick yourself into thinking launching an online business means you need to be an expert at Facebook ads and Google search and influencers and all these things that you probably think go into launching an online business. But actually, you can just be good at one of those things and have a very successful business. You don't need to overcomplicate it. So just pick one of those things you're going to focus on right now. If it's an online business selling a product, Facebook ads is probably the easiest one to get good at and focus on, and ignore the rest of the noise. So just take your product, get the website up, run some Facebook ads, and forget all those other things like TikTok and Pinterest and influencers and, you know, advertising on podcasts, sorry.
And
just get good at one thing, because you don't need to be good at all of that to have an effective online business.
Once you've had a few moments to process all the value Gabby Lewis brought us in this week's episode, please hit me up on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram and share with me your thoughts on this episode. And lastly, if you've been around the startup story for any length of time, then you know how much emphasis I put on the idea that entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. And like I mentioned at the top of the show, Gabby has extended a discount code off your entire order at magicspoon.com. So to receive $5 off your order, just use the code startupstory at magicspoon.com upon your checkout process. I say it in every episode because I believe it with my very being. Entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. So let's show up for Gabby in a huge way as a way of saying thank you for all the value he delivered to us today, and visit magicspoon.com to purchase something for yourself or for a gift for friends and family. But make sure to use the code startupstory to get your $5 off your order. And now for my personal ask. The Startup Story community has been so incredible about sharing our podcast with others, but we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We too are a startup, and word of mouth is everything. So please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Startup Story, or on Twitter at Startup Story _. If you're on LinkedIn, please search for The Startup Story and follow our company page. LinkedIn is a really powerful way to raise awareness of the show. But the most impactful way you can help us grow our audience is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you listen to the show via Spotify, then please simply share the podcast directly from your Spotify app or wherever you listen to the show. These simple actions can make a huge impact in getting these amazing founder stories out to the masses. And please make sure to tag or mention The Startup Story when you do share so that we can connect with you and say thank you directly. I'm so incredibly appreciative of the fact that you listen to the show each and every week. And I look forward to sharing these amazing stories with you every Tuesday with hopes of encouraging and inspiring you to start your story. If you like this podcast and are thinking of creating your own, consider talking to my producer, Danny Osmond. He helps thought leaders, influencers, executives, and authors create, launch, and produce podcasts that grow their business and make a real impact in this world. You can contact him today at emeraldcitypro.com/startup story.